Let me introduce you to Joel McCower. Joel's an old friend of mine who is a writer and speaker and strategist on environmental practices and clean technology and green marketing. Years ago, wrote a book called The Green Consumer. Now has written a new book for the other side of the business equation. It's called Strategies for the Green Economy, Opportunities and Challenges in the New World of Business. Hi, Joel. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Paul. Doing great, thanks.
Nice to talk to you. In a recession, can people worry about being green?
Well, are you talking about companies thinking about this during tough economic times?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends a lot on what you're doing, but so much of what we talk about when we talk about, you know, so-called being green, being more environmentally responsible, has to do with being more efficient, saving money, cutting costs, and sometimes attracting business, being more competitive by being known to your customers more, whether they're consumer customers or other businesses. So this isn't necessarily a luxury that we do only when we can afford to. This is actually a way that can some of these things can accelerate during tough times.
Can being green help save a company that's in economic trouble?
It can. I mean, it depends, again, on what sector it's in, if it's selling to consumers, if it's selling to other businesses. But, you know, if you're a business selling to a big retailer like Walmart, for example, you have to be thinking about and taking action to reduce the energy costs of your product and reduce the toxic ingredients, reduce the carbon footprint, as they call it. In other words, how much manufacturing and using the product contributes to global climate change and a whole bunch of other things in order simply to remain being a supplier to a Walmart or Target or Costco or Home Depot. And so, you know, that alone means that you have to be paying attention. And if you're not, you could lose out in any economy. So it certainly could save you in this one.
Does that mean that Walmart is demanding that of their suppliers?
Absolutely. They have 60,000 or so suppliers. And for the past year and a half, 2 years, it's really accelerated. They've been pushing those suppliers in both ways, both large and small, to change their product. You may have noticed, your wife may have noticed, that if you go to the supermarket now, when you buy liquid laundry detergent, they don't have those big bottles anymore. They're all half size, and it's the same amount of detergent in that same size bottle. It's called compaction. We actually knew how to do that for the last 20 years. The technology has existed to put twice as much detergent in the same size bottle or the same amount of detergent in half the size. Problem was that people didn't want to buy that. They saw the big one sitting next to the little one, even though they cost the same and did the same number of loads. We're Americans. We wanted the big bottle, right?
Yeah, right.
Walmart came along and with its big buying power and said, you know what? No more big bottles. We're only going to sell the smaller bottles. And it's big. They're not doing this to save the earth, although they know that there's environmental benefits, but it reduces shipping costs and packaging costs and restocking costs by having smaller bottles. So you multiply that times tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of products, and you can see, first of all, what the potential for Walmart, and not just Walmart, but lots of other retailers to save money, but also to their suppliers to have to really, you know, turn themselves inside out just to be in business.
So they're thinking of the green back first, and it's having a green domino effect.
Well, you know, the two, you know, people used to say the two were at odds, the dollar, you know, the economy and environment. And, of course, we've known that for the last 20 years or so. That's not the case, that they're very much interlinked. You can't have a healthy company in an unhealthy environment, and that being a green company is really in some ways just being a better, more efficient company that it can attract employees and attract customers and have higher quality and reduce risks and a whole bunch of other things that you know, in addition to whatever contribution it has to reducing climate change and all the other problems we face.
I know you've consulted some companies when it comes to green marketing. Does that work on the consumer level, or is it something like what you're talking about? It's simply the economy of scale of a large operation demanding that of their suppliers, and so the end product turns out to be greener whether the consumer wants it or not.
Well, you know, it's a complex question, and I'll try to keep the answer short, but as you mentioned at the top of the show, I've been covering this for 20 years. 1989, I wrote this book, The Green Consumer, and I've been watching this sort of dysfunctional conversation between consumers and companies where consumers have been saying for years that they want to buy green products from good companies, but really don't, at the same time, they don't want to change anything, their brands, their habits, where they shop, you know, how they use products, anything else. They just want the products made greener for them. And so as a result, they don't really go out of their way in some of the green, the overtly the green products that make marketing claims haven't really succeeded. That's starting to change now with we're seeing big companies like Clorox and others come out with green products. But as I say in the book, one of the ironies of all this is that we've become greener consumers in spite of ourselves. I mean, just for example, one of your hometown companies, Anheuser-Busch, has figured out, you know, how do you, you know, reduce the amount of aluminum in an aluminum can? And they've redesigned it, they've reshaped it, they've thinned the can in a number of different ways, and without reducing the volume, and they're saving tens of millions of pounds of aluminum every year. And when you think upstream about the environmental impacts of mining bauxite and the fact that manufacturing aluminum has it requires so much energy that it's one of the top greenhouse emitting industries, that's a significant environmental achievement. But they're not going to put a green seal on Bush and Bud.
Yeah, you're not going to sell more Bud Light and tell people they're helping the environment.
Exactly.
That's not going to be the marketing tool there. But the thing is, you're saying that there is a measurable impact on the environment from these business decisions.
Exactly. And again, I mean, go back to the laundry detergent and the beer cans and thousands of other things that we're buying are being made with far fewer resources and energy and water and materials and creating far fewer waste. It doesn't mean that we as consumers are off the hook and we just sort of have to wait for them, whoever they are, to figure it out for us. But I'm just saying that in spite of the fact that we've sort of, you know, been talking out of both sides of our mouth, we want products, the companies to step up to the plate, we want to buy the greener products whenever possible, we're not doing that, but we're actually, you know, doing a lot better than we think.
I remember when you first started this and you came out with the Green Consumer almost 20 years ago, you wrote about companies that were dedicated to coming out with environmentally friendly products. Have they been kind of pushed aside as these corporate giants have grabbed hold of this and run with it more than they ever could?
Well, some of them have, you know, come and gone, as you see, any time there's a trend or a fad or just a, you know, the normal course of startup businesses, you know, not all of them survive. But there are some, like Seventh Generation, based in Vermont, which is now more profitable than ever, and as big companies like Procter & Gamble and Clorox and Arm & Hammer are coming into the market with green cleaners, they're sort of lifting all boats. And so they're just as, you know, when Starbucks came into a market, they didn't kill local coffee makers. In fact, there's more local coffee shops in a market after Starbucks arrives because they create a market for something that didn't exist, expensive coffee. And in the same way that these big companies are now creating markets for smaller companies that where it just had niche audiences, now the smaller companies are doing much better.
Joel, just before the break, you mentioned Starbucks, and I know you've got a story in there about a blogger, I believe out in California, who took on Starbucks over the coffee beans they were using. What's that story?
Well, a number of years ago, Starbucks made a commitment that you could go into any Starbucks in the world and buy a cup of what's called fair trade coffee. Fair trade coffee is coffee that's where the beans were, the people who picked the beans and grew the beans are paid a fair wage, and unlike some traditional coffee beans, where they're often exploited or, you know, paid pennies of what they're worth. And fair trade is fair trade chocolate and fair trade, lots of fair trade products you can buy now, where usually independent groups come in and help ensure that the people are being not only paid a fair wage but being working under safe and healthful working conditions and things like that. And so Starbucks is one of the largest buyers of fair trade coffee, and they don't necessarily feature it as the coffee for the day, but if you know, you can go into any Starbucks and order almost any kind of coffee using one of those. They'll make a little pot using one of those little plunger devices. So they said they could do, they'd make you fair trade coffee anywhere in the world, and this blogger called a Green L.A. Girl, was basically a UCLA student at the time, took it upon herself to, you know, through the blogosphere, to start this campaign and think, let's test it. Go out and, you know, go in anywhere in the world and report back. And they called it the Starbucks Challenge. And of course, and blogosphere being what it was, it caught on. And Starbucks being the icon it was, people went in and did that. And, you know, and sure enough, there were a few where, you know, the baristas in Starbucks didn't quite get it or didn't know about this, or you know, but, you know, and so they turned that into a scandalous kind of thing, a little bit overblown. But the point was is that Starbucks, you know, they could have gotten defensive or attacked the people or whatever. But what they did is that basically this one woman at Starbucks picked up the phone and called Green LA Girl and had a conversation. And all of a sudden, Green LA Girl realized that Starbucks, you know, this is this person at the other end of the line who cared about the same thing she did. They found common interests. They sort of stayed in touch and it turned into a potentially bad story for Starbucks turned into something that was admirable and good, and simply by picking up the phone. And this is a tempest in a coffee pot. The question here was really whether Starbucks was being perfect or merely admirable. But the point is that companies often, you know, get into trouble and they get all defensive. And in this particular case, just the simplest human contact between a big bad company and one critic with a big megaphone made a lot of difference.
There are two amazing things about this story to me. One is that you can get a blogger's telephone number. I can never do that when I want to get in touch with somebody online. All I can get is maybe an email address on their Contact Us page. That's it. The other part of this is that I think it may speak to a larger question, which is companies making claims of environmental goodness and then perhaps not living up to them to the full extent of their promise. And you must run into that often.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the biggest problems that companies get in any case, not just environmentally, is when they let perception get ahead of reality. You know, we think that a company is solving a problem when they're not, or they make big claims about how much we care about, you know, our workers and something, and then of course they find out that there's some skeleton in their corporate closet. But you know, one of the problems about green is that we don't have a definition of that, and that's a big problem, because if you start with the assumption that the market for anything, or any trend or any kind of behavior change or anything that we're talking about here requires some kinds of norms or standards or simply shared definitions, we don't know what that means to be a green company. There are some standards for some green products, not many, but there are standards in things like green buildings and organics. But we don't know what it means to be a green company. So any company can say anything they want and say, we, you know, give a nickel per widget sold to Ducks Unlimited every third week in April. We're a green company, and so that's a, you know, and the company may actually believe that. So we have this problem where companies are trying in some cases harder than others to be greener, and consumers are skeptical, and then they find out, you know, like a blogger finds out that they're not perfect, and then all of a sudden, you know, people get cynical and said, I knew it was just a marketing scam.
Yeah, well, it's like you said before, perfect or admirable. You could be doing something that's nice and good, but it's not fantastic and great and saving the planet, and should you get demerits for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly a case. And the result is that a lot of companies, as I mentioned before about Anheuser-Busch and the beer can, they're actually walking more than they're talking, which is to say they're doing more than they're talking about, because, you know, companies get into trouble. I mean, so many of the things that companies are doing to be greener basically amount to being less bad. And that's a good thing, that they're being less bad, they're polluting less, they're wasting less. But that's a hard story to tell. It's the old, you know, I'm just stopped beating my wife.
Right.
And in some cases, there are things like, again, with the Anheuser-Busch beer can that has nothing to do with the product itself. As you said, you know, a Miller, you know, a Busch Light, you know, or a Miller Light, or any, you know, company, or Coca-Cola, you know, a lover isn't going to buy the product because the can's lighter.
Right.
And so that makes it hard to tell the story. And then beyond that, there's things that are simply just too geeky to talk about, that, because even though they may be impactful, they're technical scientific things that result in using 30% less water, you know, in the process to wash the potatoes that become your French fries at McDonald's. You know, and again, with water issues, that's a big thing, but it's not an easy story to tell.
And it's not something you're going to put in your commercials, and you're certainly not going to do a commercial that says, the runoff from our factory that goes into the river killed 40% fewer fish this year.
Yeah, or we're no longer killing fish.
Right. Yeah. Now, along those lines, what is greenwashing?
Well, greenwashing is a claim that was actually coined by Greenpeace back in the early 90s, and it was originally intended, you know, if you think about whitewashing and, you know, just covering something up or putting a, you know, just basically trying to hide something, greenwashing was, you know, companies that were putting a sort of a green sheen, or, you know, you can't use this term anymore, but green lipstick on a pig, you know. And so it was there. You may recall, and we still see some of these ads where, you know, these commercials or advertisements where you don't really even know what the company does. You just know that they like ducks, or something, or deer, or whatever.
Yeah.
And in the early 90s, that was really, there were companies, you know, there were nuclear companies and coal companies and companies that were tearing, you know, denuding the forest, that were making these green claims. And Greenpeace, I think, rightfully said that that's greenwashing. Now the term is being used basically as, you know, it's sort of a guilty until proven innocent way that any big company that makes any claim is assumed to be greenwash. Clorox is putting out a new line of green cleaners. It must be greenwash. And then you look at it and say, well, actually, they're 99% plant-based, and they clean as well as other things, and, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe they're actually pretty good, and they're strong enough to wear the Clorox label. So we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. You know, we want, again, companies to do the right thing, but the minute they do, there's a lot of people to get really critical of them because they're not perfect.
You got to overcome that green cynicism.
There's a lot of it, exactly.
Yeah. Joel, in the last couple of days, President-elect Obama has named several people to his energy and environmental team, including Dr. Stephen Chu, who's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who will be the energy secretary. Former New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection Commissioner Lisa Jackson will head up the EPA. Former Clinton administration EPA Administrator Carol Browner will be the new climate czar. Heather Ziekel will be the assistant to Carol Browner. Nancy Sutley, who's the deputy mayor of Los Angeles, will head the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Are these all people that people in the green movement like yourself approve of?
Well, I think it's encouraging. Certainly, over the past 8 years, we've seen, you know, little or no, not only no leadership, but actually rollback of a lot of environmental progress that's been made in the name of the economy. But, you know, we see how that worked out. And so, you know, these are good people. And of course, the challenge is that it remains to be seen how much one can do in this, you know, down economy. Certainly, they're people who support the idea that green isn't just a luxury that we do when times are good, that actually it can be a path out of the recession that we're in, because, you know, when we start to look at the new green economy, it's not simply about, you know, greener detergent and beer cans and fair trade coffee and some of the things we've talked about, but it's a real revolution in how we live, work, get around, travel, and live every day. I mean, we're starting to see, for example, this confluence, this mashup, as the kids would say, of energy, information technology, transportation, and buildings, you know, houses and office buildings. So this is something that we're going to be seeing increasingly over the next 10, 20 years, for the rest of our lives, really. But it's going to start to take shape in some ways, both subtle and very overt, just in the way that so many other things we've done have changed thanks to information technology, things we take for granted now. We're going to be driving electric cars. They're going to be both taking power from our homes and sometimes powering our homes or our office buildings. A lot of this is going to be done wirelessly, or we're going to be able to control these things wirelessly. And you know, our big appliances in our office buildings, the heating, ventilation, air conditioning, or even maybe the refrigerators in our homes are going to have a little address just like our computers do. It's called an IP address that can be turned on or off every few minutes and seamlessly, or regulated every few minutes seamlessly by a utility, not because they want to control our lives, but because we don't need all that electricity all the time in the grid. It helps sort of avoid having to build new power plants. So, I mean, it goes on and on from there, but what's exciting about the Obama and his picks is that these people understand the vision. They understand what's possible. They understand that being green is a way to revitalize the economy, create jobs, address energy independence, and bring in some of the innovative spirit that we've been, you know, so famous for as Americans, but have lost over the last few years. Oh, and maybe, by the way, revitalize the car industry.
Yeah, which we'll get to in just a minute here. But at the heart of this, do you think, Joel, that government should force people and businesses to be greener?
Absolutely not. No, that's not what this is about. Government shouldn't be forcing us to do much of anything except obey the law and respect one another in some pretty basic ways. But government does a lot of things every day to incentivize us to do things. It allows us to encourage us housing by making our mortgage payments deductible. And sometimes it goes overboard in doing some of these things, but it tries to encourage certain kinds of investments in oil exploration or just buying new equipment by letting businesses write things off in some accelerated format fashion. They provide incentives and grant money. They write checks to all kinds of businesses to give them incentives to do things. And over the past 50 years, those incentives have been to find more energy by drilling and digging and mining and building nuclear plants and a number of other things that have served us very, very well. But it's now time to change that because we're seeing that those, over time, we're going to need more energy than those plants can provide and also still allow us to breathe the air and make sure we don't have Katrina-sized hurricanes and a number of other things. And so we have to supplement those with some new kinds of technologies. And up to now, the rhetoric has been around, well, drill, baby, drill. Just do more of that. And now we have to understand that we can't survive on just, you know, one crop, one energy crop of oil. We have to have a lot of other crops from sunlight and wind and the heat of the earth. And they're not perfect technologies, but neither is oil. So that's what's exciting is that we're going to start to develop this diversity of sources, and we're going to innovate our way back into a sound economy along the way.
You say you don't think that the government should force people and businesses to be greener, but do you think if they're going to bail out the big three in Detroit, that part of that bailout should be oversight that requires them to become more fuel efficient in the vehicles they build and sell?
No question. They have to do that. I would like to say making good time going in the wrong direction, but they haven't even been making good time. They've been losing ground and making the wrong cars and, you know, quality and a whole bunch of other issues. And if they're going to survive, we have to require, in this case, I think, you know, this is where both you need both carrots and sticks. And you know, in any normal time, the industry shouldn't require, the government shouldn't require industry to do certain things, you know, to make certain kinds of products. The market really should decide that. But these are not normal times. And if these companies want our help as taxpayers, they're going to have to do what's right by us, not just for the economy and jobs, but for our kids and their future and our ability in, you know, in some cities that are choking with, you know, kids, you know, with asthma. They have to, you know, sort of the basic health needs of all citizens.
Where are we, Joel, on alternatives to oil in running our internal combustion engines or their replacements?
Well, we're at the beginning of a transformation that's going to take a generation. It's going to take 20, 25 years to really do this. But what's different now are a number of different things. First of all, the technology has improved. We now, you know, electric cars used to be things that, you know, they were great if you didn't have to go uphill or, you know, drive in, you know, when it was colder than 40 degrees.
Because going uphill would be a real detriment to most people's lives.
It might work in St. Louis, but certainly where I live in San Francisco, that would be a tougher thing. But, you know, they weren't very good. They didn't go fast. They didn't go far on a charge. But now we're looking at cars that can go 100 miles or more on a charge. And people say, well, that's not good enough because my car goes 300 miles between fill-ups. Yeah, but, you know, 80% of driving is under 40 miles a day. And so that's plenty. And you go home and you then plug it back in. Just like you do your cell phone or your laptop. It's not a big deal.
All right, but let me ask you a question before you go on. What if I drive 20, 25, 30 miles to work? I don't have a place to plug it in there.
Well, you might, as we're starting to see new companies crop up that are going to be able to turn every parking space into a recharging station, and increasingly employers, and I bet, you know, we'll start to see some incentives, at least at the state level, for employers to start putting those plugs in and making recharging available to their employees. And maybe employees will start to say, look, I don't want to work for you. I can't recharge my car there. So that becomes a competitive thing. But there's also a generation of cars coming, and the Chevy Volt is one version of that. that are called extended range electric vehicles, where you have, they're electric cars, and if all you do is drive 40 miles, you never use any gas. But if you need to go further than that, there's a little motor that kicks in that recharges the battery, allowing you to actually go about 600 miles between charges at the equivalent of about 100 or more than 100 miles per gallon. And that, we'll start seeing those in the next couple of years, in small numbers at first, but over time. And that's the kind of revolution we're going to be seeing. And then from there, the technology is going to continue to improve, just as they have with computers and so many other things, it's really going to be different. Our kids are going to be driving in a whole different way than we are now.
And the incentives for the automakers will be people will want these because they'll need them for economic reasons?
Well, it'll be cheaper and in some ways cooler, and they'll go fast. And, you know, I mean, a lot of these things are better products. You know, we didn't, switch from records to DVDs or from, you know, because they were running out of vinyl. And we didn't switch from DVDs to iTunes because they were running out of plastic for DVDs. We did this because they're better technologies, and people wanted them, and they were cooler, and they allowed them to do things. And we're going to be seeing that, because these are cars that are going to have a whole range of capabilities that with lots of intelligence that will allow them to talk to other cars and avoid collisions, intelligence that will allow, you're already starting to see this with things like OnStar, where you can not only get information and navigation, but eventually you'll be able to find out, you know, for example, where the nearest charging station is, and a whole bunch of other things that we're going to reduce congestion in cities, and we're going to start to see this all come together as cars, just like so many other parts of our lives, have gotten smarter.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be an iPhone app that tells me where I can go to charge my car anytime I want. But the question about charging then leads to the other question, which is, how are we going to make all of that electricity? We hear all this talk about clean coal. There's been a push recently this year by John McCain and others for more nuclear in this country. China is putting coal plants on every day. All of that can't be good for the environment. So where are we going to get the electricity from, Joel?
Well, here's the interesting part, Paul. We actually don't need more electricity to do this, because what happens is that at night there's all this extra capacity that nobody's using because we're sleeping and the factories aren't running, offices aren't working. And so if we charge our cars at night, we can pretty much meet the needs for the next couple of decades of electric cars without building any more plants. And what's going to happen over time, and this may accelerate now as part of this, what Obama, many things he wants to do, is that we're going to start to see different electric rates. Just like, remember, back in the old days, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, it used to be cheaper to call after 5 o'clock and even cheaper after 8 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night.
Yep.
That was because there was more capacity and it was cheaper, and so they said, well, charge it. Our electric rates are going to be the same. It may be that if you want to do your wash, you're going to, and washing machines and dishwashers already have timers that say, I don't want it to start for 3 or 4 or 8 hours from now. And because it's going to be cheaper to do your wash after 11 or after 6 p.m. or something than it is if you do it at noon. And it may be change even summer versus winter. And so when you put that together, this what's called time-of-use pricing with electric cars, so people, if they have to charge at noon, they'll do that, but it's going to cost them more. But if you're just a normal, you know, commuter, no reason, and you probably have, and there will absolutely be a setting on your car that says, I want you to charge this, but not until after 11 o'clock,
then
we're in good shape for a while.
Great stuff. The book is called Strategies for the Green Economy, Opportunities and Challenges in the New World of Business. If that's not enough for you, Joel is online at greenbiz.com. He's got articles in there today about how Dell is going to change some of their packaging to save money, about more and more states are requiring recycling of plastic bags and beverage companies and recycling and more. All of that at greenbiz.com. You can also read Joel's blog at readjoel.com. Joel McCower, thanks for your time today.
It's always a pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.